ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show this week. I'm going to start with ETF.com's Drew Voros. This will be fun. We're going to go around the horn on several recent stories, including Fidelity launching their flagship Magellan Fund in a non-transparent ETF wrapper. And you look, Magellan is a $20-plus billion mutual fund. So I think it's going to be very interesting just to see whether this can be a good test case for non-transparent ETFs to gain some traction. I feel like if this one can't, you have to start wondering about these longer term. We'll also talk cannabis ETFs, which this is the top performing ETF segment so far this year. And of course, this was one of my 2021 ETF predictions. This space is absolutely on fire, but I will say I'm not taking a victory lap just yet. And Drew and I will discuss whether or not this performance can hold up. And then we'll also spend a few minutes on ETF flows, just where investors have been placing their money this year. It's early, but ETFs are tracking on a record-setting pace, of course, after a record 2020. So we'll look at that as well. I'll then be joined by Andrew Beer, founder and managing member of Dynamic Beta Investments, who's behind two hedge fund replication ETFs. And Andrew has quite the background. He has started multiple billion-dollar hedge funds. Not multiple billion, but like multiple hedge funds with over $1 billion each. And he actually worked under Seth Klarman back in the day, the legendary value investor. But Andrew's brought his hedge fund experience to the ETF world. So we'll spotlight those two ETFs. And then I also want to get his take on the recent GameStop drama, just with how hedge funds were impacted by that, especially the ones who were short GameStop. I thought it'd be interesting hearing from a hedge fund insider. And then I'll close this week with a fantastic resource in the ETF space, Daniil Shapiro, who's with Cerulli Associates. And each year, Cerulli puts together a comprehensive report on the ETF industry. So this covers everything from active ETFs to ESG, thematic ETFs, direct indexing, ETF fees. They survey both ETF issuers and advisors. So we're going to walk through several highlights from that report. As always, questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can go to ETFprime.com. Let's start with ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, thanks for joining me this week.
My pleasure, Nate. I won't even mention the Kansas City Chiefs.
Well, you just did. We're still licking our wounds here. It's like 5 degrees outside. And obviously, we're a day or two removed from a disappointing loss, but it was a successful season, didn't end on the right note.
My condolences.
Well, Drew, before we talk about some of these stories, tell us about this big news from yesterday. So I saw ETFS Capital has acquired ETF.com, and I'm sure we have a lot of interested listeners on this. What can you tell us?
Sure. Well, it's a very exciting step for ETF.com. As most listeners know, we were owned by Cboe Global Markets. And frankly, media was not their core competency. They were approached by Graham Tuckwell of ETFS Capital, who many of the audience here knows was a longtime ETF pioneer and started ETF Securities. He sold ETF securities in 2018, European business to WisdomTree, and the U.S. business to Aberdeen. And so he has a firm that has other properties, such as ETF Stream, which is the ETF website covering Europe and Asia and parts of Australia, and also AltFi, which is a fintech publication. So there's a nucleus of a media company forming, and ETF.com is going to be front and center of that. And so we're going to be looking at global coverage, global offerings to our clients and customers, and advertising and events. So a lot of exciting things to come. We're really in a formulation state right now, but I have some exciting news coming. I'll be happy to share it when we're ready to.
Well, congratulations on that. It does sound very exciting, and I know I look forward to seeing what's in store here with this partnership. Okay, let's talk about some of these ETF stories. And I think one of the early ETF stories of the year is cannabis ETFs. So I was looking this morning. Listen to this. So six of the top eight performing ETFs so far, and that includes leveraged and inverse ETFs, they're all cannabis ETFs. And that's led by the Global X Cannabis ETF, ticker POTX. That's up 105%. And then if you go a little bit further down the list, there are two other cannabis ETFs in the top 20 of all ETFs by performance. And of course, I was checking today, cannabis ETFs are up again, anywhere between like 5 and 10%. Talk about some of the drivers here. I know you follow this space pretty closely. What do you think is behind this strong start?
Well, what's happened is sort of what happened in the fall. So legislation was going through Congress that would decriminalize marijuana, would also open up marijuana companies to the federal banking system. That was put on hold until the election, and the election went through. Obviously, the Biden administration is going to be much more comfortable with the decriminalization. And we just heard last week or the week before House Speaker Schumer already say that he's going to bring decriminalization to the floor for a vote. So that has really propelled these stocks and these ETFs higher, with the idea that decriminalization will open up the market much more. And maybe more importantly than just the distribution of marijuana itself, is opening up the capital markets of the U.S. to U.S. companies to grow. And that's how they're going to grow, is to tap capital markets, to list their companies on the exchanges. And that might also bring in some of the bigger players, such as the Philip Morris, such as the Constellation Brands. And so I think what we're at right now is in a real kind of buy the rumor, sell the news stage. Obviously the valuations of some of these marijuana companies that are largely Canadian-based are being highly inflated because there's such a shallow pool of available securities to put in these ETFs. I'll give you an example. For one, there's a company called Tilray, T-I-L-R-A-Y. It's the biggest holding in PotX and MJ. And in fact, the largest marijuana ETF, MJ, which now is approaching $2 billion in assets under management, it is the single largest shareholder of this company with some 6 million shares. So what you have, and it's also the top holding in POTX, P-O-T-X, which you referred to. So you have a thin selection of securities to put in these ETFs that are being bought up by all these ETFs, and the demand for these ETFs is increasing, so they're forced to continue to buy these shares. And it's, the rising tide has lifted all boats. As you said, we now have several $100 million ETFs. I think we have five ETFs that have more than $100 million. MJ is at $1.6 billion, and very interesting. Marijuana ETF Advisors Shares Pure U.S. Cannabis ETF MSOS is now over $700 million in assets. And it's a different kind of ETF in that it is investing, it's active managed, and it's by swap contracts related to domestic cannabis and hemp companies here in the U.S. So it's a little bit complicated. It's hard to wrap your head around right away, but it's obviously a U.S.-focused ETF. Actively managed. POTX is also actively managed. So what you're also seeing is some outperformance by these. I take it back. POTX is an index, but along with I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought here. With MSOS, there is YOLO, advisor shares, which is also actively managed, but it's looking at domestic and international companies. So, but nonetheless, all these ETFs are seeing demand, they're seeing performance, and how long that can last, we'll see. Because the next step is that we're going to see potentially the legalization of marijuana. How much that opens up the capital markets to these companies is really not seen yet. But we're kind of back in the dot-com days with marijuana stocks, where it's really about the potential. Fundamentals aren't really beating valuations, and there's an idea that there's a whole new market that's going to open up that will potentially bring in new players. One analogy I'll use is think about the leaders in Silicon Valley back in 2001. Not the same leaders we have today. And I think that's what you're going to see in this space, is that the stocks you're seeing in these funds today are going to look much, much more different in 10 years, 15 years. And it may include some S&P 500 companies as well.
Well, I thought that was an excellent overview of the space. I'll add two quick things. You know, something that we are seeing here in the cannabis space is consolidation. So you mentioned Tilray. They're merging with Aphria. I saw Jazz Pharma's acquiring GW Pharma. And it's not, you know, some people think of this space and they think just recreational use. The medical side is gaining a ton of traction. And I think that's a big underlying driver of what we're seeing right now. The other thing I'll mention, you went through some of the ETFs that are out there. I think investors should be aware there are huge differences in terms of what some of these ETFs hold, and what that's causing is a big dispersion in returns. So if you look at something like PodX this year, I mentioned up 105%, and then you look at, let's say, MSOS, I believe that's only up like around, you know, 40% or so. And, you know, you look at the largest pod ETF, MJ, I think that's up about 70-75%. So it sounds cliche, but investors really need to look under the hood here. I just want to point that out.
And it's also, you're talking about a lot of Canadian companies.
That's right.
And MSOS is really focused on U.S. companies, which are very nascent because they haven't been able to grow. They haven't been able to tap capital markets. And frankly, it's a much more gray area. In Canada, it has been legalized. Those companies are allowed to list on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So it's very different in that regard, but it could change very quickly, too. So a fund like MSOS could suddenly find itself riding the higher wave because the U.S. companies are going to benefit more from decriminalization than, say, Canadian companies.
100%. And we saw that last year, actually, right after MSOS launch. I mean, it came charging out of the gate and was showing fairly significant outperformance compared to some of the other cannabis ETFs. Okay, another big story last week was Fidelity launching their Magellan Fund in an ETF wrapper. And it's a non-transparent ETF wrapper. The ticker symbol is FMAG. This will cost 59 basis points. And I should also note they launched three other active ETFs last week as well, all in the non-transparent wrapper. But of course, Magellan is a flagship fund for Fidelity. I would say right behind ContraFund, at least in name. Does this change anything just in terms of the fortunes of non-transparent ETFs? Like, do you think this can maybe get the snowball rolling?
So I look at this as a real big inside baseball story. This is big to you. This is big to me. This is big in the fintech community. But it just doesn't have the buzz it used to. And I'll kind of compare it to an aging rock band. You know, the Magellan Fund was the fund in the 80s and 90s. One time it was over 100 billion. Now it's down to 20 billion. Young investors, the Robinhood crowd, don't really know what a mutual fund is. So you're not bringing that kind of headline noise and attention that maybe the Magellan Fund turning into an ETF 5 years ago would have. So I think they're really fighting headlines here and the market mania that we've seen and the way, you know, with Bitcoin, with Robinhood. I don't know where that demand's going to come from. And I'm not sure the Magellan Fund, that name alone, will do it on the retail side. Now, on the institutional side and with advisors, there's a very trusted name. The performance has always been there. And the management of those portfolios are still the same people. So I think there is definitely some attraction there, but I just don't think it's going to be as obvious at the outset. We'll certainly be watching the flows over the next few weeks.
It's just so interesting because you look at the names that have launched non-transparent ETFs over the past almost about a year. I mean, American Century, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, there are some others, and these really have not gained traction, even though if you look at a few of those specific ETFs, they've had pretty good performance. But it's like even the ones that have had good performance, it hasn't been enough to get investors in the door. And you wonder, like, what changes that? Because if you go back to the old mutual fund world, one of the big aspects of distribution was being able to pay advisors commissions to push those funds. And that model's broken down now with a fee-based RIA model. And so I just wonder, even if the performance can't get these funds to the finish line, like how can they?
You're bringing sort of this old mutual fund thought into this new disruptive space. How attractive is that just on the surface? I think that's the tough hill they have to climb, is that, you know, when Magellan Fund was the rock star, they didn't have an ETF industry to compete with. And now a lot of the things that Magellan Fund has done, you can find in other ways in ETF wrappers. And you can find it even sliced thinner than what the Magellan Fund's doing. So it just, you know, they didn't come in here with any extra advantage. They're right. Pretty much like a startup coming into the ETF industry with a fund with great performance and has past customers. How do they get those people out of the Magellan Fund into an ETF? And $22 billion is not that big in terms of ETF size anymore. So bringing in a $22 billion mutual fund just doesn't have the cachet. I think it may be the Magellan Fund coming into the industry 5, 6, 7 years ago would have had it.
Well, plus, I think if you look over the past decade or so, the Magellan Fund's actually underperformed. And then to mm-hmm. your point earlier, you have somebody like ARK Invest and Cathie Wood that you now have to compete with for the headlines.
Exactly.
And with a younger exactly. crowd, where are they going to go? Magellan? Nobody, no, you know, a lot of that crowd doesn't remember who Peter Lynch was.
And that's the problem about being slow. You know, Fidelity has been in the ETF business a long time, and we were talking about when are they going to bring these funds? When are they going to bring these funds? I think they're late to the game.
All right, Drew, just a couple of minutes left. Let's quickly talk ETF flows. And I think the headline here is that we're currently tracking for like $800-900 billion in inflows this year, which obviously that would shatter last year's record of $507 billion. I'm not saying that pace is going to hold. It's obviously market dependent to a large degree, but you and I have talked a lot about the momentum around ETFs, and clearly we're seeing that. What do you make of flow so far this year?
Well, it's like a diversified portfolio. We're seeing pops in all kinds of different parts of the market. It's not just ARK. Okay, so half the funds of that $80 billion you reference are coming into international equity funds. Last year, that was the laggard. So we're seeing a roll into that because there's value there. We see the market here in the U.S. at all-time highs day after day after day. So we're certainly seeing some value investors hunting in the international area, and I think they're being rewarded right now. But I'll give you a microcosm of what we're seeing is last week we saw the Wall Street bet crowd supposedly focus on silver. We saw this huge pop in silver. Well, we saw a huge pop in silver ETFs because it's such an easy way to access. SLV drove flows last week, some $2 or $3 billion. So when we see these kind of events happen in the marketplace, there always seems to be an ETF that fits that. And the Robinhood crowd and some of the retail investors understand ETFs so well now. So for instance, if a headline comes out with about the airline industry, they're not thinking United or Southwest. They're thinking Jets, the ETF. So I think the migration and into ETFs is becoming more and more natural. And I think that's this really driving flows. And then overall, you have this momentum coming from last year that is carrying over. And then we're seeing marijuana stocks pop with demand. We're seeing silver pop with demand. So I think we're just having all these different parts of the market that are benefiting. Our ETF market is benefiting from things that are happening in the stock market, and it's easily translated. Even we saw it with GameStop. We saw people focusing on XRT, the retail fund that had high weighting in GameStop. So people are looking for ETFs that are holding stocks as opposed to just picking stocks.
Drew, about a minute left. We were talking ARK earlier, and I know some people are tired of hearing about ARK Invest. I get it, but the fact is, they're just an amazing success story, and they've now crossed over $50 billion in their ETFs. They were at like $3 billion a year ago. And I haven't checked over the past few days, but I believe they're pretty close to moving into seventh place on the ETF leaderboard. Any quick thoughts on ARK before I let you go?
It's kind of like Tom Brady, not to rub it in, but people are tired of her winning, and she keeps winning. And she came from Wall Street. I believe she used to work at Goldman Sachs. So she knows what she's doing, and she's doing it everything the way that the ETF industry was set up for someone to succeed. They're sort of like the independent filmmaker that's taking on the studios, and they're winning. And now they're attracting all these new customers that are going to stay because the performance is there. They're attracting young customers. They're attracting institutional customers. Every week there's an ARK fund on the top inflow list, $1 billion a week minimum on a fund. So it has just become a brand very quickly, and I really see it having staying power. Now, we'll see what happens. Nothing ever goes up forever. But then again, until it falls, I don't know how you can knock it.
Well, Drew, we'll have to leave it there. Great stuff as always this week. Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you, Nate, for having me.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. My next guest is Andrew Beer, founder and managing member of Dynamic Beta Investments. He's also co-portfolio manager on two really interesting ETFs offered through IM Global Partner, the IMDBI Managed Futures Strategy ETF, ticker symbol DBMF, and the IMDBI Long Short Hedge Strategy ETF, ticker symbol DBEH. And Andrew himself has over 25 years experience in the hedge fund business. He's founded several multi-billion dollar investment firms, and he's now joining me via phone from New York. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So given your past experience in the hedge fund space, I'd actually love to start by getting your take on everything we saw a couple of weeks ago with several hedge funds apparently getting squeezed in some of their short positions, right? GameStop, AMC, there were some others, what I call the 1990s stocks. I'm just curious, what did you think as all of this was going down? And maybe you can offer us a window into what was likely happening at some of these hedge funds. Like, was it panic? Was this a big opportunity?
So it's interesting. I started writing about this in mid-January, and really it was really quite apparent that this was a tempest in a teapot. I mean, it had a very big effect on a few funds, but it wasn't a big deal overall. And I think the reality is that short squeezes have been around forever, but it's usually hedge funds beating up on weak-handed peers. This one had a few unusual characteristics, but that, we can save that for another discussion. But I think the important thing is that the talk of the death of hedge funds at the hands of some retail insurrection was always hyperbole. In reality, it probably had an adverse impact on hedge fund performance of maybe 100 basis points in January. And we learned later that some hedge funds actually made a lot of money on the long side as well. So I think, within certain hedge funds, back to your point, I'm sure there was, shock and panic as things that they thought couldn't go up too much went up 1,000% or more. But I think more broadly, hedge funds will be more careful about crowded short positions. Single stocks, particularly those that are crowded on both the long and short side, have always been an issue. Most learned this lesson a long time ago. Those that hadn't learned it, I think, will change how they handle it going forward.
Well, yeah, when I think about the risk return there, let's take GameStop as an example. And I don't remember exactly where it was trading at, but let's call it 10, 15, 20 bucks a share. What's the upside of going short something like that? Because you obviously have the unlimited risk to the upside if the thing spikes, and your gain if it goes bankrupt, let's say, if that's what your play is. It just doesn't seem like it seems like you have asymmetric risk to the downside. What do you think the thought process is there of shorting a stock like that?
So I don't know. I don't know people who are actually short the stock, but shorting is always difficult. And the general calculus is, if you get absolutely everything right, you make 100%. And if you get things wrong, you lose more than 100%. You could lose 200%. What made this weird was that you didn't lose 200%, you lost 1,000%, 2,000%. And that was because the mentality of retail investors was somewhat different from hedge funds beating up on other hedge funds. Because if you think of three hedge funds, if they were on the long side, they're very, very worried about getting stuck with GameStop at, you know, $50, $30, $40, when they know the value is substantially less than that. But retail investors, because this was so dispersed, I believe all of them thought they could get out at a moment's notice. And so really, actually, the analog that we came up with when we started writing about this was this wasn't like a typical short squeeze, because the value of the company meant nothing to most of the people who are investing in it. It was purely a bet that the short squeeze would continue. So it really ended up looking a lot like portfolio insurance from 1987, which was every pension plan thought they could hedge their equity risk by going to the futures market at the same time. But when everybody went into the market at the same time, the market dropped 25% on Black Monday. And so here, when the stock was trading about 315 or 320 or something like that, I had a conversation with a guy, and he said, you know, I don't trade individual stocks, but he said, if you had to take a position, what would you do? And I said, I would buy something ridiculous, like, you know, puts at 50 or something, you know, 1 or 2 weeks out that were literally cents on the dollar. Because when this thing starts going south, it's not going to drop 10 or 20%. It's going to go down 80 or 90%, and that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly what we saw. Do you think we're going to see more of this, where retail investors try to band together and target some of these lower float stocks that have high short interests?
I mean, probably. I mean, I think that the big thing here, though, and I think what in a sense was brilliant about the thesis, you know, and again, if these were hedge funds 25 years ago talking about this as a trading opportunity, the kind of things you saw being circulated on Reddit, now these would have been some of the smartest hedge funds in the room. So I think there's something incredibly positive about this whole, you know, event, in that it shows the democratization of investing, access to information, increasing sophistication, dissemination of knowledge, trading efficiency. All these things I think are very positive. As it relates to going forward, you know, you're not, I think people on the other side of it who got burned aren't going to be piling into crowded names in the same way. So without the fuel of too many people being short individual stocks or positions, it's hard to see how you can get that leverage on the upside. And, you know, there was an effort to kind of push up prices in the silver market, and that happened, but it kind of petered out. I think you'll see more of that, where it'll be, actually reminds me of the scene from a movie a long time ago called Animal House, where John Belushi gets everybody riled up and then runs out of the room, you know, expecting everyone to follow him, and they're all just sitting and staring at him. So I think it's you know, we'll know in a year, but I suspect it won't have as big an impact.
All right. So moving on from the GameStop story, I do feel like you're in a really unique position in that you have a window into what the largest hedge funds are doing right now. And I'd love to hear, can you talk more about some of that positioning, what these funds are doing, and maybe you can add your own sort of thumbnail sketch to what your view is on the markets right now, because I think that'll be a perfect segue into talking about your ETFs.
Sure. So our job is to synthesize how leading hedge funds are invested today and how that's changing, and then to interpret the data that we get. And so the concept is what an author named Jim Surowiecki outlined in a book called The Wisdom of Crowds, which is that, you know, what 20 hedge funds believe is a lot more accurate and valuable than what any single one believes. And so with this lens, there are three really important interrelated themes right now. The first is that inflation could come back hard, not 20 basis points above consensus, but 5% or more. The second is that the recovery is real, and this is good for value stocks. And actually, this pivot into value stocks last year drove a lot of alpha generation at hedge funds. And the third is that emerging markets are poised to benefit from themes one and two. And, you know, these themes could have an earth-shattering effect on the average retail portfolio and a whole generation of advisors who cut their teeth in the 2010s. And so I think it's actually an incredibly interesting time in the market. Looking at how hedge funds are positioned and the basis for the underlying themes, I personally agree with these views. And I think we're set up in a period right now where we basically, you know, what could be one of the largest stimulus packages ever to be launched in the U.S. At precisely the time when the economy is roaring back with probably more pent-up demand than we've seen in 100 years, at the time, same time as the Fed basically saying that they're going to let the economy run hot. So I think the broader risk is going to be rates go up a lot more than people think.
Okay, so with that as a backdrop, let's talk about the two ETFs, and then perhaps we can talk about where these belong in a portfolio. The first is the IMDBI Managed Futures Strategy ETF. What does this do?
So the Managed Futures one, we seek to deliver the pre-fee returns of 20 leading managed futures hedge funds. And the thing to understand about what we do is we don't build our own hedge fund strategies and we don't invest with hedge fund managers. Rather, you can think of what we do as it's called hedge fund replication. And the easiest way to think of it is imitation is the greatest form of flattery. We figure out how leading hedge funds are invested today and then copy it with liquid low-cost instruments to get the same exposures. So in DBMF, what we do is we analyze how these leading managed futures hedge funds are invested, and then if they're long oil, we figure out how much they're long oil by how much, and invest directly in oil through a futures contract. If they're short the 30-year treasury, as they are today, then we simply short the 30-year treasury. And so the whole idea is that most investors in managed futures have been frustrated with their performance for two reasons. The first is that single funds have a frustrating frequency of blowing up on you. And in fact, the guys who did the best last year are most likely to be the guys who blow up this year. And the second is that the hedge fund fee structure and expense structure of these things means that often everybody makes money but the clients. And so in the case of DBMF, there's about 500 basis points of fees that we seek to cut out of the structure. And basically, by charging 85 basis points, we seek to outperform by 400 basis points per annum over time without taking more risk, which is what we've done.
With cutting out those fees, is there anything you're giving up? So obviously, you're holding futures. I mean, is it that you don't have that single stock source of returns? Or what else is maybe foregone?
So managed futures is easy because managed futures just invest in futures contracts. So, you know, we have, in theory, what we would give up is we only invest in about 10 or 15 futures contracts. So in theory, there might be something in the other 60 or 70 contracts that these guys trade that could add value at a particular period in time. But the research that we did, and again, I think in order to do something like this well, you really have to understand what happens underneath the hood. And the reality is, like in most strategies, the top 5 or 10 positions are the ones that drive all the returns. On the equity long short side, DBEH, we do the same thing where we take 40 leading equity long short hedge funds. We figure out how they're making money before fees and then also invest in futures contracts to get similar exposures. And there, your point about single stock positions is a good one in that during certain periods like calm markets, we may give up a little bit in returns. Give a little bit up in pre-fee returns because these guys are investing in single stocks that go up more than the markets. But in bad market conditions, that's where trade crowding becomes a problem. And so by staying in futures contracts, we avoid the big drawdowns that you sometimes get with equity long short hedge funds. And similarly, if you look at the numbers in January, DBH was up 200 basis points. Or 300 basis points better than the MSCI world, in part because we didn't lose any money on short positions like actual hedge funds did.
One thing I'm curious about, and as I'm sure you're aware, there are some other ETFs that attempt to mimic the risk-return profile of different hedge fund strategies, but I believe they typically use ETFs to accomplish that. What do you view as the benefit of using futures contracts instead?
Well, futures contracts are simply more efficient. In one of our products, we actually did use two credit ETFs, until the end of last year, not one of the ETFs, but something we manage in Europe. And the problem with ETFs is, you know, one, they are more expensive than investing in futures and they're less liquid. And so we decided at the end of the year actually to terminate using any ETFs at all. I think, you know, in this space where people are doing hedge fund replication-based strategies, the core product idea is brilliant and works incredibly well. There's been a tendency for people to over-engineer products, particularly products that have been around for a long time. And so people take a simple, elegant idea and then add all sorts of bells and whistles. And unfortunately, I think most allocators have experienced that bells and whistles at best don't add value, but with alarming frequency can explode. And so our ethos has always been that simplicity and efficiency are incredibly valuable. And so, you know, in our ETFs, by trading in futures, we have no acquired fund expenses. The bid ask on being able to buy and sell shares should remain razor thin over time. It's really kind of understanding the client's and the advisor's experience and making sure that ultimately our goal is to find the highest probability ways of generating more return with and minimizing any ways of taking risk.
You know, you bring up a really good point when you talk about keeping simplicity in mind, because my experience in visiting with investors from all walks of life, whether that's retail investors, sophisticated advisors, whatever, I do feel like liquid alternatives have a somewhat difficult time resonating. And my guess is investors probably just find this space confusing and complex. And so I guess two questions here. I mean, one, how does that change? How can those investors become better educated? And then talk about what you view as the value of strategies such as yours in a portfolio.
Sure. So liquid alts are a mess. Liquid alts broadly defined are long and short strategies that have typically been in hedge funds that people put into mutual funds and ETFs to make them accessible to a retail audience. And the whole concept is that hedge funds can provide a lot of valuable diversification benefits. So if you can find a good way to put them in retail portfolios, clients will have a better experience. And by that, we mean portfolio won't go down as much, they'll be less volatile, they'll potentially have higher returns. The problem is 80 to 90% of products that were launched in this space really don't provide much in the way of diversification. They don't generate enough in returns, they're too expensive, or they're too risky. And so, you know, I think what's interesting now is that there's been a huge sea change in how people view hedge funds. A year or two ago, it was very popular to beat up on hedge funds. But now, given where we are, given where 60-40 portfolios are positioned, the issues with bonds not providing protection, the concerns that if inflation takes off and rates rise, the impact that will have on both equity valuations and bond prices at the same time, you have firms like JP Morgan saying that hedge funds are no longer optional, they're mandatory or they're a necessity. And so the liquid alt space is really confusing because asset managers have made it really confusing. They sell these products as hot dots, people pile into them, they disappoint, and then they're opaque and difficult to understand exactly what happened. So, you know, I guess I would encourage anybody who's confused about the liquid alt space, wants to understand the landmines, that they should speak to someone like us who's spent the past decade writing about the space, understanding it, anticipating the landmines, and trying to really provide clarity to investors, because they should understand what they're investing in and why.
Andrew, just about 2 minutes left. As I look at your ETFs, they both cost about 85 basis points. And I think most investors know, you touched on this earlier, hedge funds are typically much more expensive. I think of the old 2 and 20 model. But if you look at the ETF wrapper, obviously compared to hedge funds are gated, right? It can be difficult getting in, getting out. They're not the most liquid. Can you just expand on the value of accessing these strategies in an ETF wrapper and compare that to maybe investors who are accessing these strategies directly through a hedge fund vehicle?
Sure. Well, revolutionary, I think, about these products, potentially, obviously this is my view, is that these are products where you get all the benefits of hedge funds, but you tend to outperform actual hedge funds over time by cutting out fees, yet with all the benefits of being in an ETF. Usually it's a trade-off. You know, I want something that's liquid, and I'm going to leave a couple of hundred basis points of returns on the table to have that liquidity. I think these products, and again, I'm been studying this a long time, and I think these products, when you look back in 5 years, I hope you'll say that these products revolutionized how advisors looked at liquid alts. Because what we're basically saying is, when you look at a retail portfolio, there's great value in having exposure to equity long short. Not a single equity long short manager, not just a value guy, not just a growth guy, but a diversified portfolio, just like an institution would do. But here's a way for you to get index-like exposure to a return profile that looks like equity long short, gives all the alpha of equity long short, potentially does better by cutting out fees, yet it's in an ETF. So the idea is advisors can say, we want a 5% exposure to managed futures and just allocate it all to DBEH. Or they can say, I want a 5% exposure to managed futures and allocate it all to DBMF. And, you know, we manage a fund in Europe for a big U.S.-based asset management firm, and we recently passed our five-year track record on it. And the first thing they said when we opened our review meeting was, you know, we think we're the only guys in liquid alt space who are happy with our investment over the past 5 years. And I hope we're having a lot of conversations with people like that.
Well, Andrew, just an excellent overview this week. Really enjoyed the conversation. I absolutely think liquid alts are a space to watch here in ETFs moving forward. So best of luck to you, and thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you so much for having me on the call.
That was Andrew Beer, founder and managing member of Dynamic Beta Investments. I'm now joined by Daniil Shapiro, Associate Director of Product Development at Cerulli Associates, who's a global research and consulting firm focused on the asset and wealth management space. And every year, they do a full deep dive into the ETF industry. So they look at the latest trends with ETF issuers, advisors, investors, and they put together a comprehensive report. And I would tell you, Daniil is someone who covers the ETF space as closely as anyone. Fantastic industry resource. And he's now on the line with me from Boston. Daniil, welcome back to the podcast.
Nate, thanks a ton for having me on your program today.
All right, so let's talk about this report. It's titled U.S. ETF Markets 2020, Broadening Product Use. And again, this looked at ETF trends, primarily among ETF issuers and advisors. Let's start with a bigger picture, which is that we just wrapped up a record year for ETFs in 2020. Clearly, there's a big tailwind behind the industry. Just talk about what we saw from ETFs last year and sort of this current momentum.
Yeah, Nate, what a tremendous year it has been for ETFs. We've seen ETFs close 2020 at a staggering $5.5 trillion. And this is after the COVID-19 drawdown, which took assets down to $3.7 trillion. Over the last 5 years, through the end of 2020, the industry has grown at a compound annual growth rate of 21%. This is huge. And the industry, it's really been firing on all cylinders. And I want to jump into a few growth drivers here. So increasingly, it's not just a vehicle for low-cost passive equity exposure, but we've also seen record fixed income flows last year, over $200 billion between taxable and municipal bond ETFs. And we expect this to continue, given that it's where product development is focused and rates are low, which really builds the case for further use of fixed income in the ETF vehicle. And another item to keep track of is that advisor adoption continues to increase as they grow more and more comfortable with these products. And advisors are planning to continue to increase these allocations to about 20% of their portfolios. And just one last item to think about here, it's the active managers that are entering the space. Now, instead of intentionally or unintentionally downplaying ETFs as they were earlier, they're now telling some of the same stories that ETF issuers have been telling for years, which is tremendous for ETF education.
All right, so several interesting things you touched on there, and maybe we can hit on a few of those. You know, as I looked at this ETF report, I was actually going to start by asking you about active ETFs. But as I know you saw, I tweeted out last week one of your surveys on direct indexing, and that clearly seemed to touch a nerve. So I thought we might start there. And basically, your chart showed that about half of ETF issuers said they were looking to develop a direct indexing offering, which I've got to be honest, that surprised me. That seemed a bit high. And then I saw Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas. He sort of jumped into the tweet thread, and he made a good point. He said, are issuers going to cannibalize themselves with direct indexing now? And I'd love to just get your thoughts on that. I mean, is this a threat to ETFs? What are you hearing as you talk to ETF issuers on this particular topic?
Yeah, I would argue that cannibalize is a bit of a strong term for now. But I think the headline in the direct indexing landscape is that there is a lot happening and that it's happening quickly. but that it's still really early innings in terms of how the landscape will look and how firms will compete. And we've just seen this absolute flurry of activity in the last few months, Morgan Stanley acquiring Parametric via Eaton Vance, BlackRock acquiring Aperio, and RIA custodians are all working on these solutions. So every day we're reading about some kind of partnership. But what's kind of undecided there is this, is how these platforms will access a wide variety of intellectual property. So, you know, we see these comments, like you mentioned on Twitter, somebody wrote that, yeah, you'll be able to replicate the asset manager IP. Well, you know, I think that asset manager intellectual property has value, and we expect some of these platforms to be open architecture. So to the extent that some of these ETF issuers and index providers have active management capability, they have data, they need to figure out how they can fit into this ETF ecosystem. So, yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of these ETF issuers are developing a direct indexing offering, but it's not necessarily because they perceive direct indexing as this existential threat, and definitely not yet. So it's more of a growth opportunity than a threat just yet.
And I know we don't know for sure how this is going to play out, but let's take somebody like BlackRock, just hypothetically speaking. Would you expect them to offer their iShares ETFs? That's one tool in the toolbox. And then also to have a direct indexing platform where investors could access the similar IP that's contained within the ETFs or the indexes that they're licensing from the various index providers. I mean, how would that look? Would they sit side by side?
And I wouldn't be surprised if there were different types of solutions for different clients, depending on the assets that they have invested. So I would imagine that those on the broader spectrum would continue to access their solutions through ETFs, but that, they would be able to access both BlackRock's active management capabilities and potentially some of these other solutions in that broken down platform through an SMA, for example.
Well, I'm absolutely fascinated to see how this plays out. I do expect some of the larger brokerages, Schwab, Fidelity, I'm sure they're going to be rolling out direct indexing platforms soon. This is going to be something that I'm going to keep a close eye on. And again, I'm just fascinated to see what happens here. Let's move on and talk active ETFs, which I feel like this is definitely one of the biggest stories in ETFs right now. And we can look last week. I talked about this earlier with ETF.com's Drew Voros. We saw Fidelity launch their Magellan fund in an ETF wrapper. Of course, DFA has now launched active ETFs. Obviously, ARK Invest is a big story here. And in the Cerulli report, let me go through a few of these stats. So the first headline stat, I think, has to be that nearly 80% of ETF issuers report they are currently developing or planning to develop active ETFs. That's a huge number. And then approximately 40% of ETF issuers are either very likely or somewhat likely to launch products with a semi-transparent structure in particular. And then lastly, let me read this. So, quote, Cerulli believes that legacy mutual fund managers can no longer ignore the ETF vehicle as it offers investors a wider variety of exposures beyond passive. It is preferred by younger investors and advisors, which fits with what you were mentioning earlier. But Daniil, talk about the potential in active ETFs overall.
Yeah, Nate, we really see the semi-transparent and transparent active ETF opportunities as being absolutely huge. I think in our ETF report, we actually presented a semi-transparent ETF asset growth model. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about it because of all the underlying assumptions, but the headline there is that there aren't that many products right now, and advisors will want the products and structures to prove themselves in the market. So we only expect them to maybe gather a couple of billion this year, but a few years out, this really kicks into high gear. So we would expect assets to reach over 100 billion toward the end of this decade. But obviously, a lot of things can come up between now and then, depending on how aggressively asset managers pursue the opportunity, and yeah, who launches what. I think, as you mentioned, large active asset managers are recognizing they cannot continue to sit out as assets are moving into the ETF vehicle, and they're also recognizing that these two vehicles can work side by side quite well, as we've seen recently with EFA. So that makes us incredibly excited about this opportunity.
On that demand side, look, I think, as you know, as it relates to non-transparent in particular, I've been skeptical that investors really want this structure. And we'll see. We're early. But clearly, investors want somebody like ARK, right? You look at ARK Invest, they're now over $50 billion in ETF assets. Can you just talk more about the demand side for active ETFs and I would say non-transparent in particular?
Yeah, I think advisors see the value in these products and they understand how these products can work with ETFs side by side. I think they'll just need a little bit more time in order to get comfortable with them. And I also think that what can help is if they are offered a very interesting strategies in that ETF wrapper. You mentioned ARK. ARK is incredibly interesting to advisors because of their underlying active management approach. It's the very unique sectors they're operating in. It's the type of thought leadership that they're able to provide to clients and investors, advisors. So I think that to the extent that these products can do a better job of resonating with investors, they will be able to gather assets.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm bullish on the prospects for active ETFs overall, again, especially in the transparent wrapper. I guess if there was one main pushback to that prospective growth of active ETFs, it would probably be with smart or strategic beta ETFs, right? That you can automate active management with these products and do so at a lower cost. And I know in the Cerulli report, it noted how over 50% of ETF issuers are focused on developing these strategic beta products. But interestingly, that's actually down from 67% in 2019. And I'm curious, why do you think there's more interest right now in active versus smart beta? Because again, I feel like the sentiment a few years ago was that smart beta was really the future here.
Yeah, I think, and that's a really interesting takeaway. I think strategic beta, these types of products, they're an incredibly natural point of interest for ETF issuers. But what I think has happened over time is that these products have gotten more and more complex. So you've seen the incredibly successful wave of single-factor products. And then eventually nowadays, issuers are focused on creating multi-factor products. But then as these products get more and more complex, they also become more and more niche. I perceive that there's a possibility that these new active ETFs that are coming in, active semi-transparent, active transparent, to the extent they offer access to an active manager with intellectual property, I think they're a little bit of a challenge for strategic beta products. I do expect strategic beta to keep its market share, but we do see this cooling of product development. And I think I'd also point to flows last year. The products gathered, I think, $24 billion in flows, and that's after significant outflows from those low volatility ETFs. So to be fair, they really punched below their weight last year, given their total portion of the market. Yes, they're just not incredibly bullish on them.
Well, the other thing that I would add there, I personally view this space as pretty saturated. I mean, I feel like every time one of these strategic beta ETFs launches, I feel like I've seen it before. There's not anything really unique. And I think the other challenge here, too, is just from an end investor or end advisor perspective, maybe because of that saturation, it can be really difficult to differentiate the products. A lot of them just look so much alike, and I wonder if that's a little bit of a turnoff as well. Okay, Daniil, a few more topics. Let's go rapid fire here. ESG, which I know, as you know, is another favorite subject of mine. So Cerulli found that both ETF issuers and advisors saw the most significant unmet demand in ETFs to be around ESG and socially responsible investing. I guess the question I have for you is, do you think that demand is real, or do you think people just don't want to tell your surveyors that they're a bad person and don't care about the environment?
No, Nate, I think that the demand is indeed real. There is unmet demand. So what I think is happening is that clients are coming to advisors and they're saying that I want a product that doesn't harm the environment, doesn't hold stock in weapons manufacturers, supports specific social causes, and advisors are having a really hard time navigating the ESG ETF landscape and finding the perfect product to fit that unmet demand. I think the question that I think you're also getting at is, what is the scale of that demand? And that's really the significant question here. Is it just a few clients that are coming to advisors, or is it possible that we're actually seeing this generational shift in demand for these products? Because investors are becoming more aware of environmental and social causes. I think it's that scale? That's really the big question here.
Well, the other thing I'll add there too, we were talking direct indexing earlier. I think for investors who are very ESG inclined, I'm a huge proponent of the ETF structure, but I think direct indexing could be a better mousetrap for those hardcore ESG investors. Okay, another category, thematic ETFs. The report noted 26% of advisors seek to commence use of thematic ETFs. And I'll add something else here, too. This stat isn't thematic ETF related, but the report also noted that ETF issuers said nearly 80% of ETF assets are sourced from retail channels versus institutional channels. And as I saw that, you know, I have a theory that thematic ETFs are like a gateway drug for the younger retail crowd, the Robinhood investors, that they'll get interested in thematic ETFs and then ultimately pivot over to broader, you know, index-based ETFs, the Vanguards and iShares of the world. Do you agree with that? And then maybe just offer a few thoughts on the use of thematic ETFs overall.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting thesis. I mostly agree with that. I think to your point, neither retail investors nor advisors have all the time in the world to conduct securities research, and they want to access these thoughtfully constructed exposures. At times, these products, these thematic ETFs, they get a bad reputation because you'll see a trend take hold in the industry and suddenly a wave of products gets launched just when the hype is the highest. But at the same time, look at what we've seen last year. Sector ETFs gathered $71 billion. And that really comes down to the fact that we've seen this tremendous market dispersion. I think another argument here is that advisors are already, they're using so much of their portfolios is allocated to these core passive low-cost equity ETFs. It just absolutely makes sense for them to take a sleeve, to take a small portion, and to use that as an alpha generator. And then they also have conversational alpha, where they get to discuss these really interesting themes with their clients. And it's also possible their clients may well be bringing some of these products to them. So to the extent these products are incredibly interesting, I think it makes sense for advisors to allocate to them.
No, I completely agree. And I've talked before about what I view as a behavioral benefit of using thematics. And the way I describe this is, I believe most investors have some semblance of a gambler inside of them. We all do to some level. And I think as an advisor, if you can go to a client and say, hey, look, let's put 95% of your portfolio or 97.5% of your portfolio in a well-diversified, globally diversified portfolio, but then we'll take a flyer or two using a thematic ETF with the other 2.5% or 5%, that what that actually can do is by having that small sleeve in thematics, it can help that end investor stay invested in the other 95 or 97.5% of the portfolio. I really think there's something to that. The other point I'll add here too, just going back to the quote unquote Robinhood investor, just to be clear, what I view here is I think a lot of those traders, as they dabble in individual stocks, ultimately, I think they probably will have some bad experiences. And so I think thematic ETFs can be the next step in sort of diversifying away that single security risk. And that's why I think thematic ETFs will resonate with that crowd. There are narratives around thematic ETFs. There's stories. There's a storytelling aspect. And I think younger investors will latch onto that. I'm very bullish again on thematic ETFs as well. Okay, quickly here, I was just visiting with Andrew Beer of Dynamic Beta Investments, who, as you may know, they offer a couple of hedge fund replication ETFs. And I know the alternative or liquid alt space, that's certainly an area of emphasis for you and your research. What are you seeing here? Like, has there been any uptick in interest or what do you think the future holds for this space overall?
I think there are two stories that I see playing out at the same time in the alternative ETF landscape. On one hand, there's just tremendous opportunity to offer ETFs there because of the white space that's available to them and the large audience that you can access with a quality product. But there are also headwinds. So alternative exposures, they tend to be a little bit more expensive and complex, which doesn't really play too well with ETF investors. And another headwind is just the return environment. So we've seen this huge market bull run. And even when we had the COVID drawdown last year, and there was this opportunity for products to do better, there was so much performance dispersion that it's really important to make sure that you're investing with the right liquid alternatives product. But I guess Yeah, to close on a really positive note here, we have seen a lot of activity in these defined outcome and buffer ETFs. It just plays really well to advisors who are looking for some downside protection, upside participation. And we all know about the complex sales process associated with the variable annuity sale. So it kind of, yeah, it makes us, it speaks to a significant opportunity that's available to these types of products. We expect more entrance here.
Yeah, and another headwind that I'll offer that I actually discussed with Andrew is just the underlying complexity of some of these products, and they can be difficult for end investors and advisors to really get their head around. Now, that said, the other factor you mentioned, just the performance, we have been in a return environment where alternatives, it really hasn't made a whole lot of sense to own them. Everything else has been going up. And so perhaps once that return environment shifts, maybe advisors and investors will spend more time doing some due diligence on these products and getting educated about them. So I think this is another space that'll be really interesting to watch moving forward. But Daniil, excellent perspective this week. I really appreciate all the work you do tracking the ETF space and the research that comes out of Cerulli, and look forward to connecting again soon. Thank you.
Jeremy, Nate, thank you for having me on the show.
That was Daniil Shapiro, Associate Director of Product Development at Cerulli Associates. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through etfprime.com. Next week, I'll be joined by the Investment Company Institute's Shelly Antonievich. We're going to discuss how ETFs have performed in wild and fast-moving markets. She's done a lot of work here. And then Bob Shea, CEO of TrimTabs Asset Management, will spotlight their lineup of ETFs, which includes the U.S. Free Cash Flow Quality ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.